This hour of the exchange airs a bit after breakfast time. In the evening, it airs after dinner time, so you may not be hungry or thinking about food at the moment. Our guest can probably change that in a hurry. It might be a little strong to say that Nick Sharma worships food, but he does certainly value it highly. He celebrates food in a blog, in a weekly newspaper, and now a weekly newspaper column, and now in a book called Season. Big flavors, beautiful food. It includes recipes from several cuisines and some fusions as well. The pictures are by Nick as well. Nick Sharma does not claim chefdom. He is a writer and a photographer, and by his terminology, a recipe developer. His blog, A Brown Table, drew rave reviews and led to a weekly column in the San Francisco Chronicle called A Brown Kitchen. Nick Sharma, welcome.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me on today.
It's very good to have you. So why are your table and your kitchen both brown in those references?
That's a million-dollar question. When I started the blog, wood planks were really common as a background, and my husband grew up on a farm that's on the border of Virginia, North Carolina, right near Roanoke, and we used to get these wood planks from their farm that were discarded, and that became the brown table.
Okay. That makes sense. So yeah. That was just the backdrop for the pictures.
Right. And so I gave this illusion that I owned a big farm table, but I didn't. And so it was kind of funny. And we decided that, I decided that I was going to call it a brown table. And, well, the color of my skin is also brown, so it's kind of a play on both things. Yeah.
All right. So which came first, the cooking or the recording of it in words and pictures?
The cooking came first. The cooking came way before I even thought about writing things down to share with people. And the blog was even much after that, because the blog is when I learned to photograph and style food, because I had to, because the blog is such a visual medium and people eat with their eyes first before they actually cook the food. So the photography came much later.
So I have to wonder, now what we're talking about, because I'm just marveling at the pictures and the way you use light in them as well. These are really, it's great food porn, I guess, is the expression that goes around. but I wonder what a guy like you thinks of all those people who put up those Facebook pictures of like, look what I had for lunch.
Well, I think it's exciting because that's how I started too. It's not like the first photograph I took was the most beautiful or spectacular photograph, and I still don't think they are the best, but they're good. But you have to start somewhere, right? And you have to look at your work and be critical and say, okay, this is what I need to improve. This is what's good. This is what's bad. And so I think that's fine. People should share their food photos if they want to. It's also a way for me to learn and see what people eat, what they like, what they don't like, what's going on in the world of food. So I enjoy it.
Well, good. And you've got quite a collection of flavors in this book. I mean, I'm fascinated by your background. What makes Mumbai, your birthplace, so diverse in its cuisine?
Sure. So Bombay, I call it Bombay because when I left, it was still called Bombay. And I always argue with people that the airport code is BOM, so I'm not switching. But Bombay was historically a port that was on the west coast of India, and it's also the financial capital of India. So you had people that were coming from all over the world to trade, to immigrate. And so you had all these people coming from Africa, from the Middle East, from Britain, from Europe. And when they came in, they brought their influences with them. And a lot of these people stayed on, or they moved on, but they left a mark. And a lot of that is seen through food and history. And of course, that the British ruled India. We've also had the French that were part of the country at some point. You also had the Portuguese. And so all these influences play a very big role in how food came into India. And Bombay is such a diverse city because of that. It makes it so rich in its wealth of knowledge when it comes to food. You've got all these flavors that you wouldn't expect, but they are there. And a lot of times they just put together, which makes it so exciting.
Within your own family, there's a bit of diversity as well, I understand, in your background. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so my dad's from the north. He met my mom in Bombay, and my dad comes from a conservative Brahmin Hindu family. And my mom's Roman Catholic. Her family comes from a Portuguese colony called Goa, which is a little south of Bombay on the west coast. And her food is predominantly much more meat-focused. There's a lot of coconut in it. My dad's food is mostly vegetarian. His family's food is mostly vegetarian. There's a lot of dairy involved in it. And so when I grew up in their household, you had the two of them kind of bring the flavors that they grew up with to the table. And I didn't think anything of it. I thought everyone ate like that. But, you know, as you get old and you'd go to your friends' houses, you realize, no, that's not really a thing. So that, you know, in itself turned out to be one of the most fortuitous gifts that I could have ever received.
That is quite a gift to have that broader background growing up. And then some of the other influences in your extended family, I was really laughing at your grandmother not using garlic and onion. Why won't she use those, or didn't she?
This is my grandmother from my dad's side. So in conservative Hindu families, this is something that used to happen a lot before, and now the practice has died out quite a bit. So when a woman becomes a widow in a Hindu family, and this is not in all the communities again, in the Hindu family, they give up onions and garlic because it's considered a heating ingredient that heats the body up, which consequently makes it an aphrodisiac of sorts. And it's sad, but they would make women not eat these ingredients because they had to live a life of solitude, so to speak, and keep them away from having so-called impure thoughts, which is kind of weird if you think about it, and sad. And so my grandmother would use asafoetida when she cooked for herself to mimic those flavors. And I remember growing up as a kid, all her kids would tell her, you don't have to do that, it's fine, like eat your onions and garlic. But because the practice was so ingrained in her head, she just couldn't. She was so comfortable cooking for others with it, but just wouldn't do it for herself.
Wow, that's an amazing story. And there's another story about asafoetida and how it smells before it actually gets heated up. And we'll talk about that in a few moments with Nick Sharma. His book is called Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. He brought the recipes to us, and he also took all the pictures in the book, which is a rare feat in a cookbook these days. It's a lot of fun to look at, and your mouth will water as you turn the pages, as ours did. We'll get back and talk more with Nick, and you can join us by phone or email if you'd like to. On the other side of a break, this is the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're taking a world tour of food, in a sense, with Nick Sharma, who has a great interest in food and knows a bit of different parts of the world. He is originally from Bombay, India. He still insists it is called Bombay. He lives in the San Francisco area now, and he cooks and takes gorgeous pictures of food. What was a blog grew into a weekly column in the San Francisco Chronicle. It was a brown table and then a brown kitchen, and he's written a book now called Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about some great minglings of flavors from around the world. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Nick, what brought you to the United States?
So, I was looking for a better future. I was gay, and I knew that, you know, living in India at the time wouldn't be the safest place for me. So, I decided to pursue higher education in America and came here for a graduate degree. I went to Cincinnati, Ohio, where I studied molecular genetics, and then later moved to Washington, D.C., where I worked at Georgetown Hospital at the Department of Medicine.
So, how good is the food variety in D.C.?
It's spectacular, and I feel it's growing a lot more now. I was there last month while I was on my book tour, and I feel like the food scene is growing and increasing exponentially. Ethiopian food is really huge in D.C. because they have a large Eritrean and Ethiopian population that lives in Adams Morgan. Historically, that's been one of the most strongest cultures or cuisines that's out there. There's also Ben's Chili Bowl, which is another famous joint to visit on U Street.
Well, it's a lot of fun. You know, I've described you as a cuisine sponge. You seem to soak up just about everything. Is that fair?
That is fair, yeah. I mean, I think that's a good part of doing what I do, is that I get to experience all these things and then learn from those cultures, learn from those experiences, and then do something with it that's different in the kitchen. And so, yeah, I could see myself as a sponge.
Well, we have more influences to talk about later on, too. Fried chicken, for example, from Southern cooking with your mother-in-law. But to a larger point about your life, though, it sounds like you could have made a pile of money in medical research. How hard was this decision to focus on food?
It was frightening. because I had no experience going into the food. I had written a blog, and at that point, and that was all the experience that I had with me. What happened was I had moved to California with my husband after he got a job, and he had changed careers, leaving the military, and wanted to do something new. So I told him, I said, hey, so you're switching careers. I feel I kind of want to do the same thing now. And he said, okay, go ahead. And I thought I'd go to culinary school to apply to a couple of places in the Bay Area and then went for the interviews. But the loans kept scaring me. And I decided it might be better for me to just go work in a kitchen and get the experience and then see if I wanted to go to culinary school. And so that's what I did. I ended up working at a pastry, at a patisserie in South Bay in Santa Clara, and did that for about a year and a half and enjoyed my time. And that was my first walk into an actual kitchen, you know, getting into a much more professional setting to see what the world of food was beyond the blog.
How different was it to work in a professional kitchen versus a home kitchen?
Well, for one, I had to listen to everyone and do what they told me to do. I had to churn out things on time, but I also had to make sure quality was always consistent. So that was a very important skill to learn. And then the other thing that was exciting was I wasn't working by myself. I was working with all these people who essentially came from all different parts of the world. We had two Vietnamese cooks. There was a Japanese kid that was in charge of the desserts. There was a baker who was from the South. A lot of people just from all over and a lot of interesting backgrounds. So I really enjoyed that experience. It was very different from what I had experienced throughout my life in academia.
Did you start the Brown Table, the blog, while you were still working at the patisserie, or did that come later?
That came much before. So the blog happened in D.C. before I moved.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I got a taste of what it was to blog, and that's when we moved to California. And then I said, well, let me just take this a step further and see if I want to work professionally as a cook.
So I understand that there's a sour note here, that being brown and gay online drew some trolls, and I wonder how deeply that affected you and if you stepped back for a while.
It did. It was kind of difficult because at the time when I was working in the kitchen, I wanted to photograph food the way it was being prepared, do a lot of instructional photos so it makes it easier for people to understand. And so I started to photograph myself. Another aspect of that was I kind of wanted to represent the people also that were with me in the kitchen, because having had that experience, I realized that a lot of them never come to the front of the kitchen and you really don't see them. And so I kind of wanted to reflect on my experiences and, you know, just do this in my own way. And so when I started to photograph myself, I would get online comments from anonymous people about the color of my skin being too dark or too ashy or looking like burnt hockey pot. So that was very uncomfortable because I had it was one thing to criticize me on the quality of my work. It was another thing to criticize me on who I was, which is something that I couldn't change. And so that became really difficult for me. And of course, then my sexuality. And so I took a step back and said, you know, do I really want to do this? And if I do it, then, you know, it's going to be a rough ride. So I decided that I really like food, which is why I wanted to change my career, which is why I started to do this stuff. And I said, if I give someone else that power to change the way I think and take something that I love so much away from me, I lose in the end. So I did, you know, it took me a couple of weeks to come to that decision. But when I came to it, I felt much more in control of myself and what I wanted to tell the world. And I did what I wanted. And over time, the comments just subsided.
So A Brown Table was the blog. It led to the weekly column in the Chronicle called The Brown Kitchen. And now we have the book Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. Nick Sharma, the author, our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. You start the book with a flavor glossary, Nick. Can you give us a starter set of new seasonings, the first tier above what you find in most American kitchens?
Yeah, so based on what I've seen now in my mother-in-law's kitchen, she lives, like I said, on a farm in the South, and based on what I've seen at my friend's kitchens, you definitely see a lot more spices than you would 10 years ago. I've seen coriander and cumin being used quite often. You also see a lot of people now use Himalayan pink salt. That's something that I rarely keep in my own kitchen, and I see my mother-in-law keeping stacks of Himalayan pink salt in the kitchen, which is bizarre, but she has that. And then you also see a lot of people now experimenting with different types of chili peppers, fresh chili peppers. That's becoming more common. And I kind of like that because no longer do I have to describe pepper as a pepper when I'm referring to them, or chili pepper. I can refer to the type that it is. Because even a type of pepper makes such a huge difference in a dish because there are so many varying degrees of heat and flavor that they bring.
Right. So you can refer to it as an habanero and people will know what you're talking about now.
And I, you know, and the fact that more and more people all over the country in different parts of the country are having access to this makes it wonderful.
You know, I have to ask about chili peppers a little further because honestly, I'm a little frightened when I go look at that section of the produce here because I know they are very different one to the other. Some, you know, they all have great flavors, but some are so much hotter than the others. You just, you know, is there any good rule of thumb for picking chili peppers out at the market?
I mean, if you're scared of heat, I would say I would go with something that you've researched before. Because if you taste it, usually with spices, I tell people go taste it raw and then taste it with salt or some other kind of seasoning just to kind of understand how it works. But if you're afraid of heat, I would not recommend someone and tell them, like, go and taste a raw chili pepper by itself. What I would tell you to do, in fact, is to go and look at the Scoville units, which is a scale that people have developed to look at how intense a pepper is in its heat. And so I would start with that. Go with something, if you're in the milder range, go with something that's much more mild. For me, I really like serrano peppers and Thai chili peppers. One's hotter than the other. Thai chili peppers are a little hotter. They're tinier, but hotter. And if you want to cut back on the heat and you just want the flavor, you can remove the mid vein or the midrib that's in the middle and get all those seeds out because that's where the hottest part of that ingredient is called capsaicin, which causes the sensation of heat. Get rid of that and then use it. You don't have to use the whole chili. If a recipe says to use the whole chili, use half, cut back. You know, those are things that you can scale. And then there are things that you could do if you're doing an infusion. Don't grind the chili in or don't chop it up. Just slice it in half, let it sit, and then discard it once you're done.
You know, particularly for you growing up with what I gather was fairly spicy food. I mean, have you had to tone down some of your recipes for American tastes?
So this is something that I, you know, tell people. I actually didn't grow up eating a lot of hot food.
Ah.
So I actually cannot handle super hot food, which is why I think it's easier for me to write about and create recipes that aren't too hot because I personally cannot handle my chest burning. And I also want to taste the different spices that are in the dish, the different ingredients that are seasonal, the key ingredients in the dish. And so I think sometimes what happens with an overuse of heat is that the heat, the sensation of heat just overwhelms everything else and masks the flavor of the other things that you want to taste. It's the same thing with sugar. And so you have too much sweetener, you won't taste the other things that you really want to taste in your dessert. So I try and play around with that. And I always start my recipes with low heat. And I tell people, hey, if you want to like amp this up, by all means, go ahead and do it.
We're talking to Nick Sharma about his book, Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. It's an outgrowth of his blog, A Brown Table, and his San Francisco Chronicle weekly column called A Brown Kitchen. He shoots all of his own pictures, which is incredibly rare for somebody putting out a cookbook. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760. Questions about what Nick's presenting here or some questions about cooking in general, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I want to go back to the flavor glossary up front, and it's an impressive list here from roots to florals, and I wonder how big is your collection of flavorings at home in Oakland?
Because I cook from home and I develop recipes, I usually have a large number of spices and flavoring ingredients at my hand, but I always tell people you don't need to start out large. I do that because I have to do it professionally for work, but I think start small. Start with something that you've never, one ingredient that you've never tried before. Play with it a little bit, get comfortable with it, and then bring in new things. And I think that will make you a much more confident cook, and you'll also be more excited.
Do you find that other cultures are a bit more willing to fuse flavors than Americans? Or Americans more like, I like it salty and nothing but, or, you know, don't put my sweet and my sour together, that sort of thing?
I think it's definitely been an evolution from what I've seen in food literature and from what I've seen with trends now, especially with restaurants are a good gauge to see what people are actually doing. You see a lot of chefs also that are exploring other cultures and kind of trying to bring those flavors in. You see that with Japanese food, which has become extremely popular and I feel in many cases has taken the place of French cuisine, the impact that French cuisine had on American food in general. You see a lot of influences coming in from Japanese food now and a lot of American restaurants. umami. Umami is something that's made a big impact, and that's from Japanese food as well. It's gamjo. And you see chefs playing around with these ingredients like miso and, you know, other kinds of also fermented products. So I think it's exciting. I think food is not something that's static. It's something that dynamic that constantly is evolving. And you can't expect it to stay in one place. Also, people are migrating and moving around all the time. So these influences, it's but natural that these influences will make their way into culture.
And speaking of a fusion of different parts of the tongue, the first recipe in the book in a section called Small Bites is grilled dates and raisins with black pepper and honey. That sounds fascinating.
That's one of the easiest things to do. It's also something that my dad used to do as a kid. We did not have a grill and we had a gas stove. So my dad would take skewers and then poke raisins, large raisins or dates on top, and then stick them into the fire for a couple of seconds till they got a little charred. And then you get that nice crispy skin on top from the caramelization, and season them with a little bit of salt and black pepper. And that was it. And he would call that his barbecue fruit. And that was delicious. So I said, you know what, that's going in the book because that's something so easy. Everybody has most of these ingredients on hand, and it makes a great topping on just plain yogurt, Greek yogurt, or, you know, you can add that to your breakfast granola in the morning. You could just serve it as a side with cheese also. There's just so much that you can do with it.
It's really interesting because the picture you have, it looks like skewers of barbecued meat, but there's nothing meaty in there.
Yeah, it's just fruit, dried fruit.
So I noticed a sumac in your flavor glossary, and for those of us mm-hmm. who got warned about poison sumac growing up, mm-hmm. not the same thing, obviously, but here it right. is in a chili sumac pomegranate nut. So what is sumac?
So sumac, there are two types of sumac. There are several kinds, but the one that you referred to was the poisonous one, which is grown in North America, but we don't use that. You can also get the edible kind, which is what I use in the book. It's a berry that's reddish, and it's sun-dried and then ground to a fine to a coarse textured powder. And the Romans used to actually use it before they introduced lemons into Rome. It's been a part of North African culture most of Africa, in the Middle East, even in Iran, and they use it for its sour note. It's got this citrusy sour note, and it's great when you don't want to increase the liquid volume of a dish, but you want that freshness, the brightness that comes from lemons, and you just do a little bit of a sprinkling. You'll see it on Iranian tadik, which is a rice dish. You'll see it sprinkled on top. You'll see it sprinkled on grilled fish, and I use it a lot. It also has a beautiful texture, so it's a great ingredient just to finish a dish off like a garnish.
So I wonder how much trial and error you've had, Nick, in trying, I'm sprinkle a little bit of this. Okay, I'll sprinkle a little more. I mean, have you had some real disasters right. that made you go, oh, boy?
I did try once. I think the first time I tried sumac, I thought, oh, you know what? I don't have lemon. Let me add sumac to make a broth. And I did that, and I boiled it for a while, and I added too much because I assumed in my mind, well, a lemon produces so much liquid. Let me add the equivalent of sumac, which is not, I should have known better. It doesn't make sense. And I went with that, and it was a very tart broth. So I had to add more water and, you know, like mellow it down. But that was probably the most terrible thing I've probably done with sumac. But a little bit goes a long way. Thankfully, that was something also that was fixable and wasn't permanent.
Well, you won me over with the broiled herbed oysters, and then as if that didn't get my mouth watering enough, there are three more pictures of the preparation process. What kinds of herbs go into your broiled herbed oysters?
So the broiled oysters are inspired by my time in New Orleans where they do the Rockefellers. It's a really easy recipe. A couple of spices go in there, like coriander seeds, cumin, and then it's also got a serrano pepper in there. I've got fresh cilantro leaves, and then all you do is you blend it down to make a thick paste. That's folded in with melted butter and breadcrumbs, toasted breadcrumbs, and then you spoon that on top of the oysters that have already been shucked. Add a little bit of Parmesan, and then also I forgot to say there was lemon juice that was added before in the herbs to give that acidity and brightness. And then you stick the whole thing once you add the Parmesan into the oven and let them broil for a couple of minutes, and then pull them out, and they're ready to go.
Lemon, I'm just surprised consistently at how many different recipes use lemon for just the very kind of thing you talked about. It's almost like a sharpening of flavor for other flavors.
Mm-hmm. So lemon and lime, I play with both a lot because in India, lemons are not that common and they're actually really expensive for most people once you do find them. So I grew up using limes and that's what my family used when they cook. Limes are much more acidic compared to lemons. They have less sugar too, so you don't get that as much of a sweetness if you directly taste it. I like limes when it comes to building on a much more fresher profile. Also, if I want to build on spiciness or heat of a dish, limes work much better than lemons. Lemons, I find them to be much more mellow. Lemons are also a great agent, and you can also use, I use this in the book, there's a dried lime called Omani lime, which is from Persian cooking. They dry them and it adds a good smokiness to a dish. So I use that to make broths often. That's a different way to use a lemon or a lime.
All right, I was going to ask about the Omani limes. I did notice them in there, but we have much more to talk about with Nick Sharma. His book is called Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food, recipes developed by Nick and pictures taken by Nick as well. So he didn't have to hire a photographer and have arguments with him. He had arguments with himself. We'll come back and talk more about the book and what's in it, and you can join us by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Nick Sharma, who I would best describe as a food adventurer. He has loved food since growing up in his native India and has brought his recipes to the West and added to the list quite a bit. He lives in the San Francisco area now with his husband. He started a blog years ago called A Brown Table that drew rave reviews that led to a weekly column in the San Francisco Chronicle called A Brown Kitchen. He shoots his own pictures, and so his words, pictures, recipes all come together in a book called Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. You can join the conversation on the exchange, ask questions about some of the things in cuisine we're talking about here, or make your own suggestions. 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Jamie in Medford dropped off a question about recipes involving okra or chia seeds. I know that right up front you have a recipe for chickpea battered fried okra, and I guess the major question, Nick, about okra is, do you have to fry it to get it to not do that slimy thing?
You don't. The main thing with the sliminess is that once the vegetable is cut and it hits water, that's when the sliminess starts to ooze. And so I was taught by my family that when you cut okra, make sure the okra, after you rinse it, is thoroughly dry. So I use a bunch of just kitchen towels to wipe them gently and slice them thin. Start with young okra. Don't buy okra that's too old because that's tougher. The sliminess will happen in a stew. So if you're making something like a soup with okra, it doesn't make that much of a difference there. When you're frying, it doesn't make a difference because if you keep it dry, it's fine. And once it hits the oil and it's coated by the batter, it goes away.
And I'm glad that Jamie asked about chia seeds because seeds do seem to be quite a big part of your kitchen vocabulary.
I do use a lot of seeds, especially spices. Chia seeds, not so much. I do use chia seeds sometimes, and this is not in the book, but you could use chia seeds if you're making a lemon poppy seed cake. Swap out the poppy seeds and add chia seeds in there. It adds the same beautiful texture, and I love to use it there. Another place that you could use chia seeds is soak them in water, and there is an Indian dessert drink called Faluda, which is made with rose water and milk, and it's obviously sweetened. So you then pour the chia seeds that have been soaked in water. They get this little gelatinous layer outside each seed, which adds a really interesting texture because the seed inside is crunchy, but then you've got this soft like gel that's sitting outside the seed. And so they put that in milk and they drink that. That's another way to do that. Traditionally, it's done with basil seeds, which also swell up just like chia seeds. So I actually substitute chia seeds and it works well.
We're getting into a whole realm here, though, when you're talking about the gelatinous layer around the chia seeds, the idea of texture. And I think we often think of color and heat and flavor, mm-hmm. but texture is a big part of food, too. And I wonder if that's something that was always there for you, if that's had to develop as you developed your recipes.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I had to learn as I started to write recipes, I had to pay attention to texture, because sometimes things might sound really great on paper and they might even photograph well, but when it comes to the texture, it might not work. You don't want something that's built and tastes just like baby food constantly, right? I like a mix of textures. I want something that's maybe soft, then something that's a little stronger, and then something that might be crunchy. So you could bring all those elements together, and I think texture is such an important part of composing a meal or a dish, and I think that's something that's often overlooked.
There's a discussion in the book a couple of times of fried chicken, that this is an embrace that came through your husband and his mother. And there is a popcorn chicken recipe in here. And I do wonder, though, Nick, along the way, if there have been some dishes that you were introduced to that you ultimately just said, okay, I tried and moved on and never went back.
Oh, let's see. Damn, that's a hard one. You're going to get me into trouble. There are things, that I've experienced and I didn't like. I don't like turnips. So you'll never see me cook a recipe with turnips, no matter how heavily seasoned I could do it to mask the taste of the smell. I dislike turnips extensively.
All right. Another question here is about another fusion kind of thing, where you've got vanilla bean pod in your recipe mm-hmm. for crispy pork belly bites. What's going on there?
So, pork belly is something that was new to me. I ate bacon in India. You do get bacon. So I ate bacon in India, and I've had Goan sausage, which is a type of chorizo that's made in India. I've had that too. But when I moved to America, the concept of the pork belly was something very new to me in that shape, in that form, the crispiness, but then the richness of the fat, and then the little bit of meat that's sitting at the bottom. So I fell in love with that. And one of the things I wanted to do when I was writing the book, I said, I want to do this in my own way, bring flavors that I grew up eating, but I also want to try something that's a little more floral and see if that works with pork. And vanilla bean is from a flower, from an orchid, and it has this amazing floral note that we use extensively in almost everything. You see it in desserts. You see it also added to a lot of physicians also use it when they want to increase appetite in people. You give vanilla because it's a sensory, it's a sensory note that our minds really love. And so I said, I'm going to try this out and see if it works in pork belly. And so that's what I did. I infused it into the pork belly, and it's in the, when you cook with it, as well as in the sauce that goes on top. So it's a bit spicy, it's a bit sweet, and then it's got this unusual aroma coming from the vanilla bean. And it all works.
I'm actually looking at that recipe for crisp pork belly bites right now and marveling at the photography, because it looks like single light source from above with you putting sauce onto the pork belly bites. How do you get these pictures done? I mean, you
a lot of practice.
Is there anybody helping you in the kitchen, or is it just?
No, I do it all by myself. But I've also been doing this for years now, so I've kind of streamlined my process. I know what my faults will be, where I'll be a little better at. So I've learned to tweak the system to work for me.
Huh. Do you shoot with a video monitor or something that allows you to see what's being shot as you're shooting it?
I have my camera has a screen that I can look at, mm-hmm. but beyond that, no. I also don't like to shoot tethered. I'm not a big fan of tethered. I try to avoid that practice, because I feel when you're out on the road and doing something, if I'm shooting for someone else, then you can't always have the luxury of shooting tether. So it's better for me in that instant to know how to photograph well without having to depend on something that's tethered.
What do you mean tethered?
So tethering is a system that was developed a couple of years ago, and you can use this in different cameras and different softwares, whatever you're using, Lightroom or whatever you use. Basically, you connect a cable to your camera, and then you can see in real time how the photo will actually look on your screen before you actually take the photo.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It does make it, it's very useful for still life, but if you're on the road, it's not possible, and I try to not depend on that too much.
That makes sense. Okay, keeping it pure, keeping the purity in the photography process. Let me come back to the food. You mentioned chorizo in passing just a moment ago, and you do spell it differently in the book. So is this a different Portuguese style of chorizo?
It's a different style of Portuguese. It's also a different spelling that's been Indianized in India. So the place where the recipe that I share from is from my mom's family's hometown called Goa, which used to be a Portuguese colony. And they call it chorizo, but it's spelled different. So I tried to stick with that spelling for this, for the purposes of the book, because that's where the recipe was inspired from. But you could call it either. I mean, I wouldn't be offended.
Okay. There's in this section on salads and soups where chorizo first appears, there's a cocoa-spiced bean and lentil soup. And this is really interesting about how you use cocoa, because you actually list it among the umami ingredients, not among the sweet or
yeah.
Otherwise.
Yeah, because cocoa is it comes from a bean, and then cocoa is also a fermented product. It's not something that naturally looks like that. The cocoa, at least that we get, people forget that it's a fermented product. And so the powder by itself is very bitter to taste if there's no sugar added to it. And this is, I'm talking about unsweetened cocoa powder. It's bitter to taste. There's no milk or anything in it. And it has an umami note, like coffee does. Like coffee and tea have the savory quality to it. Chocolate also, not chocolate, but cocoa actually brings that. And in Cincinnati, when I lived there, there's a place called Skyline Chili, and they do this over there. They use cocoa to season their chili. And so this is where actually the idea came from. And I said, wow, they're using that there. Let me see if it actually works in my kitchen. And so I tried it out, because the dish is essentially a vegetarian bean dish. It's a bean soup. And what I wanted to do was see if I could increase the depth of umami by using cocoa. And it did. And so I said, okay, this works really well. I'm going to put this in the book, because I think this is something that people have in their kitchen and they could use it in a different fun way.
Does it sometimes surprise you still that stuff that tastes one way prior to cooking will taste very differently once it has been heated?
It does. And that's what I love about this process, that every day I'm discovering something new. I might have worked with, say, cumin for the longest time, you know, used it in maybe 100 different ways. But tomorrow I'm going to find out another 100 different ways to use it, and they'll all taste different, which is so exciting.
So have you had some triumphs? You know, it's like people doing, oh, this is great, this is wonderful. And then you couldn't recreate it? You couldn't get the same flavor out of it again?
This happens to me with smoking. Uh-huh. And I feel smoke, and this is also something that's hard for me to to tell people to really replicate something when it comes to smoking, because there are so many different devices that people use for smoking. You've got the smoke gun, then it also varies by the type of wood that they might decide to use, to create that flavor. And then that is something that I've always found a bit of a challenge, is to recreate the same intensity at the level, because smoking is also something, in a way, it's infusing. It all varies so much depending on the number of times you open the smoker. You know, you're losing smoke. So smoking is something that's always been a challenge for me, but I'm getting much better at it.
Yeah, I can relate, though, because having tried it myself, too, a few times, it's like, you know, the difference in the kind of wood, the wetness of the wood, the outside temperature, all those things. There's just so many variables involved.
Yeah.
So there's a good aside that you provide in the book about the whys of seasoning. What were some of the basic rules you learned from your mother and grandmother?
So my mother doesn't like to cook, which is probably why I cook. So I learned a lot of my cooking from my grandmother. And one of the things that I always remember, it's still in my head, when I prep food, I don't tell people that you have to be an excellent cutter of vegetables. You don't need to cut your things beautifully and make matchsticks and all that stuff. Cut how you want. The main thing is just cutting them all to the same size and shape. That makes a difference when you're cooking, because then your cooking time is uniform. If you have vegetables, say even potatoes or carrots, that are cut in all different odd sizes and shapes and they're all in the same pot, they're not going to cook at the same time. The larger ones are going to cook, take a longer time to cook. The smaller ones will be overcooked by the time you get to the larger ones. And so those are like the little things that can actually make a difference. You don't have to be perfect, but that is one of the things that I learned from my grandmother. Another thing that I learned was just being patient. It's okay to have simple recipes and simple dishes, but sometimes it's important also to have patience, because not everything needs to happen in a day. Some things actually taste better or cook better if they're left overnight. Like in the book, there is a sweet potato babinka, which is a dish that you should make the night before and then stick it in the refrigerator for the eggs. And the it's basically a baked pudding. So you want the egg after it's baked to kind of get firm. And if you eat it the day off, it's not going to taste that good. Eat it the next day, it's going to be firm. It's cut like a cake. It's beautiful. And it's got a better taste. So, you know, those are the things that I always insist to people, that you can have simple dishes, be patient in the kitchen, because all these things actually you think might not only make you a better cook, but they also make you a much more confident person.
Right, right, right. The I love the fact that, yeah, stuff in the refrigerator overnight often tastes better the next day after it's been prepared.
Yeah.
I have to ask before we go about naan, because I love to eat this in Indian restaurants and have never tried to make it at home myself. Is it difficult at all?
It's not. So naan is not something that I grew up eating in my house, but it's always something that I got at a restaurant, even in India. And so when I came to America, a lot of my friends would ask me for a recipe for naan, and that's the recipe that's in the book. So what I do is, you don't need a tandoor, which is the oven that the naan is baked in. All you do is you take a skillet, and I use a stainless steel skillet. Don't use a nonstick skillet. I've noticed that it burns faster on a nonstick skillet. Use a stainless steel skillet or a cast iron skillet and cover it with a lid. The lid helps to replicate the conditions of the tandoor where the moisture is held in, because what they do is they take the bread, they stick it on the hot surface, and then shut the oven. And that helps to create the blisters and the bubble on the bread that you see on naan. So it's really easy. All you need to do is just wait for the bread to rise, the dough to rise, and then stick it in the on the skillet, which takes a couple of minutes.
All right. It's wonderful stuff. We have barely even touched some of the recipes in the book, and there's a lot more that that you could enjoy by getting the book yourself or looking at Nick's blog, which again is called A Brown Table. Nick Sharma is the creator of Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. The pictures and the recipes, all from him. Nick, it's wonderful work. I can see you have a lot of joy in your cooking. Thanks for sharing it with us today on The Exchange.